Welcome, everyone. Thank you for joining the Muslim Philanthropy Podcast at American Muslim Community Foundation. Today we have on Sania Vashist. She is the founder and executive director of Code Her. Welcome to the show, Sania.
Thank you so much for having me. Glad to be here.
Of course. You know, we had you on for the annual symposium and the Muslim Philanthropy Awards, and you won in the category for young philanthropist. So congratulations on that. And we're really excited to be sharing a little bit more as we're highlighting women-led and women-focused initiatives for Women's History Month.
No, it was a great event. Thanks for organizing it. And I'm glad to be back and share a little bit more about what we're doing at Code Her.
Yeah, for sure. So why don't you share a little bit more on your background, kind of where you grew up and you know, your identity as a woman of color growing up and everything like that you would like to share?
Yeah, definitely. So I grew up in Brooklyn as the parents of two immigrants from India. And so, of course, there are a lot of nuances in my childhood that came from, you know, the Indian American experience, being a woman of color growing up. It kind of became more apparent to me when my family moved to Missouri, when there were, you know, very few people that looked like me, had the same experiences I did, especially when my interests didn't always align with the other, you know, girls in my school or in my grade, you know, interests related to technology or even sports or, you know, video games. And that sort of came along, but my parents were very supportive of my interests, especially my mother, who was, you know, very intent on me just following my passions and not having to, you know, confine myself to the stereotypes that an Indian girl or, you know, a girl in the United States had to. And she said, just be interested in what you're interested in. And she supported me. You know, she was very intent on, you know, you don't need to play with dolls. You can just play with, you know, cars, or, you know, you can build things instead of just having to do, you know, the different toys that they're selling in the girls section of Target or Kohl's or whatever. And so that, you know, mentality that my parents instilled on me, that, you know, your interests are your interests and being a woman or a woman of color doesn't define what you can or can't do or what you're interested in or what you're not in, really helped shape my childhood. And so even though I was the only girl playing football outside or basketball outside, there was never a point in time where I felt like I didn't belong. It was just, I was there and that's what I was interested in. And it ultimately got to a point where I was telling the other girls, you know, like, playing sports is cool. Like, you know, coding is cool. Like, you know, get involved in this. This is really interesting. And so, of course, you know, I didn't see a lot of immigrant parents also telling their young daughters that, or, you know, their girls that, you know, you can be interested in anything. And oftentimes there is the embarrassment of, you know, you just follow the stereotype so no one's going to talk about us. And I'm sure, you know, a lot of people watching this channel also have felt that. But it ultimately came down to, you know, my parents having the courage to just tell me, you know, it's okay if people are talking or people look at you funny, like you're just doing what you're passionate about. As long as you're confident in that, that's what really matters.
Yeah, I think that's pretty critical to have that support from your parents and enriching that experience for you. So what were some of the things that, you know, you mentioned, like football or basketball and coding, like what was it about those things that made you interested in them?
So football kind of came about just where I grew up in New York. A lot of the people on my street and a lot of my friends, they were also interested in football. So I just kind of got interested in that. Basketball, I've always loved to just play. And sort of when I grew up, that's what I was exposed to. And so when I moved to Missouri, it was more of a shock that, like, you know, like people here aren't doing that, you know, and maybe just a change of geographical location was kind of that culture shock to me. But, you know, in high school, you know, I played intramural flag football for a local team. Like, I continued those interests. But of course, over time, especially, you know, girls, you know, they have these interests in elementary school and middle school, but as they get older, they start to conform to peer pressures of, you know, identifying with these different stereotypes or doing more girly things just because they want to fit in and they don't want to stand out or, you know, get that negative attention that sometimes people do get.
Yeah. And what would you say kind of from your experiences growing up kind of led you to want to start Code Her And if you can share a little bit more about the organization as well.
Yeah, of course. So I started Code Her the summer before my freshman year in high school. So I was around 13 at the time. And it just began by me, you know, looking at back at my middle school experience, realizing there was never, you know, a computer science class, that girls in my area weren't really interested in that. And so I thought the most, you know, apparent need or the most evident need was to introduce, you know, girls to computer science, to engineering at the middle school age, get them exposed to that. So when they go to high school, they continue to pursue those classes. And, you know, from then on. And so, you know, originally it became as a very simple concept that I was just going to go to local middle schools, teach computer science, get middle school girls excited about the concept, show them that there's no one way to look like an engineer. Even though, you know, at that time, you know, there were like the Mark Zuckerbergs, the Bill Gates, but no one that looked like them or, you know, seemed like them. And so for the first year and a half, that's what we were doing. We were, you know, in the Mid-Atlantic area running after school girls coding programs, summer camps, weekend workshops at public libraries, especially targeting, you know, economically disadvantaged young women that came from low-income backgrounds, exposing them to computer science. And it was around a year and a half when, you know, I did some research and I kind of understood the global climate a little bit more and realized that the conversation of women in STEM and women in empowerment and women in entrepreneurship was really starting in the United States, and it was being propelled and pushed by different nonprofits, you know, governments, governmental institutions. But then, you know, you look halfway around the world and it's not even about women in STEM. It's just, can you get them into the workforce? Can you get them to complete their education? And I thought that our model and our programs would be better implemented, you know, in the Middle East, North Africa region, South Asia, and the Global South in particular. And so that's when I was like, you know, let's just take this international. And so our first destination for that was in Morocco. And so that was in 2018, where we had our pilot program there, partnered with local institutions and ran our social entrepreneurship program. And so in our program, you know, young women from low-income backgrounds come in teams. They identify a problem that their community faces and then develop a solution using technology. And so we really, you know, walk them through the entire startup or startup nonprofit process and, you know, developing a mission statement, a vision for their organization, creating their websites, their applications, social media accounts, logo, working on the branding, the digital presentations, the business proposal, really helping them develop a sustainable plan for their nonprofits. And so they come out of our program with a project that they've developed with these tech skills that they, you know, continue to hone in on through creating apps, websites, you know, social media accounts and everything in our process. And so we love our model just because not only are we just like teaching them these different skills, but they're building something with it and they're creating something that they later present to people and, you know, get funding for. And so it's a really nicely drawn out process in which they're developing confidence. And finally, you know, there are people in a room that want to hear what they have to say, want to hear their ideas, and people are giving them support for, you know, what they have created.
I think, you know, the way that you describe it, it's almost like an incubator where you really support them and allow them to theorize what the solution could be. And, you know, providing all of that in-depth support, sharing your best practices. And, you know, it seems like you yourself went through a similar process to kind of develop Code Her, and you're sharing that skill set with these other girls across the world. So like first, like, you know, A, very inspiring. And then B, like as a teenager, why were you so focused on like doing all of this? Like, I remember as a kid, I was probably just, you know, not even thinking globally at that point, just really in my own world. And, you know, what led you to, try to start something that would be able to have this scale and impact?
So in the beginning, you know, I wasn't even thinking about going international. It was just going to be, you know, a local community project. But then, you know, with my interest of learning about different cultures, different regions, and hearing the stories of young women from different countries, I became really fascinated with the international vision that we had developed. And, you know, originally my parents were like, why don't you just do something in India? You know, we have family there, we know people there. But, you know, I was very intent on, I want to go to a new country, a different area, learn from, you know, those people's experiences, partner with local, you know, organizations, and really figure out what can we do for them, and, you know, how can we develop a more global society within that. And so, you know, looking back on it, I'm like, I don't really, you know, I just kept on going, and I don't think I was ever thinking of my age being a barrier. I sort of, you know, kept on pushing, unless there was like a legal document where I realized like, wow, I really am not 18 or old enough to be filling this out. But throughout the process, of course, support from family was huge. And it was really special to be able to teach girls at an age similar to mine. And that peer-to-peer learning we found to be very instrumental in our program. And so, you know, we went to Morocco in 2018. In our first program, we reached around 30 young women. The next year, we were able to scale up to 4 more cities, reach 550 with the support from the U.S. Embassy in Rabat and the U.S. State Department, and great partnerships with local organizations. So just seeing that scale over time, I think I couldn't imagine have not doing that. And it's just the momentum that was kicking in, and, you know, just seeing all of these new projects take place and develop, that's what, you know, kept me going and kept me excited about what was to come.
And in terms of like partnerships and the ability to kind of see this through, because A, you know, you had high school, and then B, you had this project that is turning into like a labor of love. What did it take to kind of see this mission through, and who were those partners that kind of helped you execute on that?
Absolutely. So when I, you know, decided to go international, and I kind of honed in on the Middle East, North African region, I just started emailing different professors in the region. And through a connection of mine, I was put into contact with a professor, Elizabeth Myers, at American University, that had, you know, extensive networks in Morocco, and within the Middle East, North Africa region, especially for, you know, women entrepreneurs. And so she's the one that really put me in contact with local institutions that she'd worked with in the past, American language schools, because, of course, you know, our program could be run anywhere, but it's about finding the right people in those countries to work with, and having them, you know, establish the credibility and the networks that we could tap into. And so, especially for our program, the recruitment of the girls is a huge part. We really want to make sure we're reaching the right demographic of young women. And so our biggest challenge was, how do we find low-income young women in Morocco that can also speak English? Which is often, you know, a third language for many, and only a language that the elite can access. And so there's a partnership with that organization. They had already taught low-income women English through the U.S. Embassy's, you know, English language program. And so we were able to work with them to find those right young women. Our funding, you know, the first year was, we went international, was very low. And so they provided their facilities free of charge, technology access free of charge. And so finding the right partners was crucial for our program, especially, you know, our pilot year, when we really had no idea how it was going to work and what it was going to look like. Having an organization and a school that was very intent on helping us, was excited about our mission and wanted to impact, you know, and provide impact for low-income women in their city, was huge. And, you know, things could have gone very bad. It could have turned out to look like, you know, a number of ways, but finding the right partners, we've known, especially when going to different countries and going international, is crucial for our program to pan out.
And in terms of those collaboration and partnership, and finding the right people, you know, I think, you know, there could have been dozens, if not hundreds, of people that you could have tried to reach out to, but finding that one that really helped take your organization a little bit further. What was that process like, just trying to find the right partner?
Absolutely. So we were lucky that, you know, our international advisor, Elizabeth Myers, was able to locate and, you know, pair us up with that first institution, the American Language School of Kenethra. And then after that, you know, we realized the larger organization, they were part of the American language schools within Morocco. So sort of reaching out to other organizations within those, within the parent organization. The U.S. Embassy in Rabat had put us in contact with different organizations they also thought could be good fits because they had vetted them in the past. And so we worked with the American Language School of Agadir, as well as a couple of other ones. And sort of, you know, the embassy provided their support and, you know, connected us with the right people. We, on our end, you know, scheduled some initial meetings and see who kind of reciprocated that same passion and that same energy for our program. And it wasn't just looking to squeeze money out of us or whatever else. And so finding the organizations that were also interested in helping low-income young women, because oftentimes, you know, organizations like to reach out to those that are part of the higher, you know, income bracket that they can actually pay to participate in the program. But we were fortunate that they had contacts in rural areas, that they were sort of able to bridge the gaps there and bring them into our program from remote locations within the region.
Thanks for sharing on that. You know, 2020 and 2021 obviously will be different in many cases due to COVID-19. So how has CodeHER kind of shifted through the pandemic to still provide programming?
Yeah, absolutely. So of course, you know, especially with the symposium being entirely virtual and your programs as well, is that especially when our organizations rely so much on the in-person contact, those connections that are being built, having that face-to-face interaction, which is so key to the relationships we're trying to build within our program, it was definitely a big adjustment to figure out, you know, what can we do to still maintain the level of, you know, effectiveness of our program and have that same impact, but also, you know, be conscious of the pandemic and public health guidelines. So unfortunately, you know, we haven't had any in-person programs since the pandemic hit. And when we were looking to scale even more internationally, especially since young women are disproportionately affected by the COVID-19 pandemic, we really wanted to make sure that those that were impacted the most had our resources and had our program available to them. We recruited, you know, a larger international team and, you know, regional directors in the Middle East, North Africa region, South Asia, and Eastern Sub-Saharan Africa. And so we had local contacts there. We launched our virtual Young Women's Leadership Series. And so monthly we have, you know, a virtual Zoom conference and we bring in panelists to, you know, talk about and discuss different topics, anywhere from economic empowerment and financial independence to women in tech, women's leadership. This month, actually, we have a women's independence conference to talk about how, you know, young women in developing countries can tackle the pressures of early childhood marriage, early childhood bearing, how they can, you know, continue their education, continue their careers even after being mothers. And so we have our Young Women's Leadership Series that we're that we've launched, and that's entirely virtual. And you know, coming soon, we have a virtual program that we're going to be helping, you know, young Palestinian young women start their own nonprofits. So as you were saying, you know, the Social Entrepreneurship Incubator, that's going to be launching in Palestine in March. And so we're going to be having a 5-week virtual program in which we, you know, walk them through the stages of starting their own organizations. And that we're really excited about, to finally, you know, have, you know, our initial, our social entrepreneurship program launching there. And then we're also going to be running that same program, you know, through a hybrid model in Pakistan, and then later in India this summer. And so we're trying to be creative, you know, figure out ways that we can make our virtual programs equally as engaging, provide that same mentorship that we have. And so, you know, we have great trainers that are coming on and providing one-on-one support to our students. But at the end of the day, it's our social, you know, entrepreneurship incubator that we really want to see launched in different areas. And, you know, now that's virtually, you know, we're able to reach a wider audience. So that's what we're grateful for as well. You know, in our virtual Young Women's Leadership Series, we've reached around 1,400 women from 22 countries, which has been amazing. And so we have young women all the way from, you know, Jamaica to Iraq and Iran and South Africa joining in. And, you know, sharing ideas and the networking events that follow. And so that's been really good for us to see and, you know, talk to women we may have not interacted before if it wasn't for the pandemic.
It's really exciting to see the continued growth of Code Her. In terms of, you know, on the nonprofit side and running the organization, you know, I would assume a lot of this takes resources. So can you talk to us about some of the funders that you've approached and kind of how you've been able to keep the organization going?
Yeah, absolutely. And so for projects that we apply to, we know how we have specific grants. And so for our program in Morocco, we have the U.S. Embassy in Rabat fund our program there. We're doing trying to do the same thing from the U.S. Embassy in New Delhi for a program in India as well as in Pakistan. And so those are more project-based funding that we're getting from, you know, different grants we're applying to. We have monthly donations coming in from employees at the Gates Foundation as well as Verizon Media Foundation. And so through the employer, you know, matching donation system, we're able to get those. And then, of course, you know, monthly donors that are able to chip in. That's been great for us as well. And so, of course, it's been difficult, especially, you know, we're an entirely volunteer-based organization. We don't have any salaried employees. And so everyone on our team are young women that are, you know, contributing their time to volunteer for our organization and take part in our organization's activities. And I've been grateful that, you know, I took a gap year before going to Stanford next fall. And so I'm working on this entirely full time. But the ultimate goal is to actually have a, you know, a staff and a salaried team so we can continue to build on, you know, our programs and to expand our reach even further.
Great. And, you know, people can find Code Her on Instagram at Code Her Girls or online at CodeHerGirls.org. What are, you know, the needs of Code Her in terms of like volunteers or how can people get involved?
Absolutely. So we're always looking for volunteers and that, you know, information is available on our website. You know, we have positions open on our team for volunteers for, you know, our marketing team, our program management team, conference direction. And so, you know, whatever ways we, you know, people want to contribute, we'd love to have you. We're actually launching a newsletter and a blog. And so we're really excited about our blog in which we're going to be taking submissions from young women all over the world and having them share their stories, particularly how, you know, the pandemic has affected them and provide them a space and a corner on the internet to share their stories and have their voices heard and interact with other young women. So we're excited about that. You know, of course, we would be truly grateful for any donations, you know, people are able to provide. That is also available on our website. I think the main thing that we're noticing in this pandemic that access to technology is a really big indicator of how people are able to move on and move forward in this pandemic. And so one of our main challenges is how do we reach young women that don't have access to laptops or, you know, internet access? And so we're trying to fund that, especially for our programs that we're launching in Palestine and in Pakistan. So if anyone's able to, you know, chip in money for that, we would be, you know, really appreciative and to kind of, you know, minimize these inequalities and these barriers that women have around the world.
That's really fascinating and, you know, hope that we can help boost the social capital of Code Her through this podcast and engage more volunteers and donors for your project. You know, in terms of, you know, your transition to Stanford in the fall, you mentioned you're taking a gap year right now. What do you want to try to pursue at Stanford?
So I hope, you know, my work with Code Her really exposed me to international relations and, you know, economics, and especially when we partnered with different intergovernmental organizations, with embassies, you know, the inner workings between different countries and different policies that affect, you know, young women and minorities was, you know, really interesting to me. And I really want to get into global development on a larger scale. And so Stanford, I'm not decided entirely yet, but I think international relations and economics is sort of where I'm heading, and to go into public service and global development, and hopefully, you know, work on policies that are able to provide a wide scale impact, bridging, you know, inequalities, empowering youth, young women in developing countries is sort of where I see myself headed. And so that's the goal. not exactly sure what that looks like yet or how that's going to pan out. But hoping, you know, I have time to figure that out. So that's what I'm really excited to pursue in the future and kind of figure out where that takes me.
Yeah, definitely. It seems like you'll have a lot of opportunities. And I'm sure once you take a few classes here or there, you'll lean towards something that you'll find is meaningful. And really looking forward to just, you know, following everything that you do. It seems like you have a really bright future ahead of you and you'll be able to accomplish so much.
Thank you so much, Muhi. It was great, you know, to be here today. And I really appreciate you, you know, interviewing all of these great women-led organizations for Women's History Month. And I think, you know, as more people can be aware of what different organizations are doing and the challenges and the struggles that women are facing in the U.S. and abroad, you know, we can have those conversations of feminism and gender inequality on a larger scale. So thank you for using, you know, this podcast to share those experiences and stories.
Of course, AMCF is happy to, and we're looking forward to just being a partner in this space and uplift other organizations that are doing fantastic work. So